Welcome to the Fourth Watch Podcast, a curated conversation with some of the most interesting voices in the media. I'm Steve Krakauer. Today, I talk with someone who's been at the forefront of the digital media landscape for decades and also happens to be my boss. Chris Balfe is my guest. This is episode 41. From how he got his start as a teenager working for Glenn Beck, to what traits top talent in the media all share, to perception versus reality when it comes to conservative media. We begin with CNN Plus's demise 1 year later. We've had lots of conversations. I'll go back to tracing when we first started talking. I think it was back in about 2010. So we've been talking about it, but never actually done an official on the record conversation. So this will be interesting. I wanted to start with a story that I think kind of encapsulates a few different things in the media landscape right now. And it is that we are 1 year from the shutting down of CNN Plus. This happened in April of last year. You were quoted in the Washington Post talking about that, you know, this was really, it existed for like a few weeks. You said it had nothing to do with the success or failure of the CNN Plus launch. It was killed before we could ever know whether it was a successful product or not. But it was really the first step of like the new CNN administration. And, you know, CNN Plus in general felt like this confluence of the old media with the new thought process, or maybe where things are going. It's certainly a world, you know, it's particularly kind of like where things are going that you've been, you know, deeply enmeshed in for a decade plus at this point. So I wonder, you know, looking back on it, but also kind of looking ahead to where things are going in the industry, what do you think about CNN Plus shutting down, but also really just now a year in, where's the landscape? Where is the places for growth in this environment that feels pretty unsteady for a lot of these more traditional legacy media outlets?
Yeah, I mean, I was at the CNN Plus launch party. So, you know, there was a little bit of a feeling in the room of like, this is ill-fated, or, you know, is the launch party going to be the close party, the wrap party? You know, I think that it wasn't as bad of an idea as people now think. You know, I think it's become a little bit of a punchline. But the reality is, like, you know, CNN is a premium, you know, product. CNN is not trying to get, I don't think, you know, your average everyday person who, you know, just wants to know the headlines. And so the idea that, you know, of having higher production quality, higher production value shows, and, you know, putting them in a streaming service that's paid, it's not an idea that I dislike. You know, I think you could quibble with a lot of maybe the show choices and the execution of those things. But, you know, I think that clearly, you know, paid content, streaming paid content is a proven, you know, it's not like, is this going to work? I mean, right, obviously it's about long-term sustainability of the content spend. But, you know, you're talking about services that have hundreds of millions of subscribers. So, you know, directionally it was right. Maybe execution wise, it was wrong for a variety of reasons. But, you know, I still think that opportunity exists in paid streaming media. Obviously, you can see what the Daily Wire is accomplishing. You know, Fox Nation will never tell us their numbers, but I think there's, you know, some decent number of subscribers happening there. You know, so I think, again, right idea, wrong, you know, execution maybe, but I mean, clearly, you know, paid streaming services are still the future of media.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it was at this time, maybe even a little bit later in the process when, you know, streamers like were just throwing money at like massive amounts of money at anything and beyond just the news side. I mean, this was, you know, the Netflixes of the world and Amazon's, Disney Plus and you know, the HBO Max. Now everything, it seems, is paring back, at least looking at the landscape and trying to be at least a little smarter about this and saying, okay, yes, there's definitely a path for streaming, but how do we do this in a smart way and not just, you know, money is not unlimited in these enterprises now. I mean, do you think that's a symptom of just where things are economy wise, or is it like getting smarter about what the actual business of streaming is?
I mean, I think the arms race is still ongoing, so there is a risk to pulling back on those things right now, and companies are doing it reluctantly because, you know, investors and Wall Street is making them. Right. I think, you know, if you said to, you know, Ted Sarandos or David Zaslav, like, would you love to keep spending like you were a couple of years ago for the next few years to really solidify yourselves as one of the big, you know, three, whatever that number is going to be.
Yeah.
You know, clearly they would. I think they just have to kind of now say, well, the market's changed. Investor expectations are different. And now we have to show restraint. But the risk of that is, you know, if somebody is able to show less restraint than others, that they may end up getting a head start here, or you know, more of a head start than Netflix, you know, had. So I do think, you know, there clearly are smarter ways. You know, what's interesting is that they seem to have all decided that they all want to serve everyone, right? So you look at, you know, Netflix is very clearly saying, you know, we want to serve everybody in the US, but we want to serve everybody globally. And now, you know, HBO Max, which had a premium, you know, product and premium feel to it and premium price to it, is supposedly next week going to, you know, be rebranded for a more mass audience to appeal to everybody. And, you know, we know Peacock and Paramount strategy. So, you know, I think that while we talked about the sort of news streamers and like a service like Box Station, which could exist with, you know, successfully with 10 million subscribers, you know, these guys are all going for the grand slam. And, you know, that does make it very hard because, you know, how many of those do we need?
Right. Yeah. I, you know, all of these conversations about streaming, I have to say, remind me, frankly, of just, you know, the original thought process that you had behind what was started as GBTV became the Blaze in June of 2012, but was started as GBTV before that. And in sort of, I feels like, you know, thinking about it now, very much ahead of the game in terms of where the business was going and thinking about ways of reaching people. Obviously, it was more niche in the sense of like, we're talking, not talking about, you know, millions of people, but hundreds of thousands of people, but there's a massive business in that. And being kind of a really first mover, it felt like, in that was hugely successful. So tell me about what was the thought process behind that? I mean, do you think is that a fair assessment of saying kind of this is where the business is going and trying to get ahead of that?
I mean, we were so early. Definitely, it was a thought about how you know where it was going. You know, the origin story around that was, you know, just being a Red Sox fan based in New York, and so you know, we had the opportunity to watch and experience MLB TV before, you know, anybody was really doing that at scale. And you know, it was a frustrating experience in a lot of ways. You had an old Roku device that, you know, needed to do it every day. And, you know, there's buffering and there was all that. But you could see, like, this is what it was, you know, eventually all content was going to be delivered this way. And so, you know, when Glenn, you know, decided that it was time to leave Fox News, you know, we were thinking about options, and this was, you know, we already had a pretty successful streaming business with, you know, with a podcast subscription and a few other things. And so the idea of, you know, going direct to consumer for the whole network was, you know, something that we thought was, you know, wasn't going to be a cool idea and something that people would eventually come to. And, you know, we did partner with MLB Advanced Media on that launch, ended up using the technology that they had built for baseball and being one of the first to really kind of help them customize that for use, you know, with other partners and networks, which became a big business for them. And you know, ultimately, a lot of people ended up using BAMTech. But yeah, it was clearly, it was so early that we had to send people Roku boxes. Like, people didn't have connected devices or smart TVs or anything like that. I mean, we picked 50 top, you know, friends and family of influencers, as you might have called them now, but we didn't then. And sent them all like a physical Roku box that we shipped them with a note from Glenn telling them, like, here's how you can watch this.
I don't think I was in that 50, but I definitely got a Roku box from you guys at the time when I was a reporter. I remember that. Yeah, well, this is sort of an aside, but the BAM, MLB Advanced Media, what ended up, I mean, they obviously, I remember, like, there was a WWE partnership, Disney, right? How did they end up? I mean, they obviously crushed it far beyond just the baseball side of it.
Yeah, BAMTech ended up getting spun out of the baseball side and then sold to Disney for like $3 billion or something like that. So the MLB owners ended up getting a nice big paycheck from, you know, being some of the people who created the original, you know, concept around allowing others to stream. And, you know, it's good for them because baseball owners needed the cash.
How has conservative media evolved over the past couple decades, and how much of the toxicity is perception versus reality? You mentioned Fox Nation, obviously an offshoot of Fox News, you know, still a huge powerhouse that, you know, I guess barring some massive Dominion settlement or something, I think they'll be fine either way. But, you know, they're obviously at the top of the game. But then beyond that, there is, you know, a real marketplace. Obviously, you know, you have experience with Fox when Glenn Beck was there. And, you know, there's the quote that, you know, I think it was Roger Ailes who said we're serving a niche that's half the country. I mean, it's obviously, there's a huge marketplace for conservative media. You know, you're now involved in it in a couple of capacities, let's say, but what do you think of, I mean, are we still in this Wild West in a way of things shaking out when it comes to serving it? Are there different pipelines for different sorts of a maybe fractured conservative landscape, or like where does it all shake out right now overall in the landscape?
Yeah, I think there's a few people that are starting to get some scale outside of Fox, and you know that's a good thing, because I think, you know, as we've seen in traditional media, as you know, companies the size of Disney feel like they're not big enough and they have to go by Fox, or companies the size of Warner Brothers and Discovery decide they need to merge, you know, the same thing I feel like needs to happen in conservative media, where, you know, there's too many subscale players and not enough major, you know, 800-pound gorillas who can really sit at the table with legacy media and have conversations about the platforms and all the types of things that we need to have conversations about to have a successful business. So, yeah, it's my belief that conservative media needs to get bigger. And there are a few players that are succeeding, you know, in doing that now. Rumble is one who's, you know, had a lot of success lately in, you know, their SPAC, you know, going public thing. And they've been spending money on content. And, you know, certainly nobody has missed the content spend that's coming out of the Daily Wire. So yeah, there are a few that are getting big enough to be, I think, you know, to get to a place where they really can be competitive long term.
Yeah. Do you think there's an area where you mentioned, like, the, you know, the Warner Brothers Discovery goes, and in order to try to fill an area that they think they're underserved in, goes and tries to scoop up some sort of conservative media? I mean, is it still sort of untouchable in this landscape, or is that something that you think could be a valuable avenue for them?
It's completely untouchable. And it's actually why there are so many, it's the reason why conservative media is like it is, right? And I get this question a lot from reporters, which is like, you know, sometimes reporters call me and say, well, you know, how come there's so much, you know, MyPillow on Fox or so many gold advertisers or whatever? It's like, well, it's because if there was any mainstream advertiser, you guys would write stories nonstop trying to get that advertiser to fall, right? Right. You know, mainstream media reporters and media reporters in general become activists when they start writing stories about every advertiser that's advertising on a conservative media show and how dare they do it, you know, not using those words, using more clever words to hide what they're trying to accomplish. So, you know, I think that because of the nature of the restriction of advertising in conservative media, and because also it goes even further than advertising, advertising is actually a symptom of the actual problem, which is the creation of a narrative that 50% of the country's views are not just right or wrong, they're toxic, they're, you know, bad, they're not views that you can hold or espouse, you know, publicly, right? So if you're a company and you want to have, you want to celebrate any view on the left, you are praised and you are considered to be social justice warriors and you are considered to be, you know, virtuous, and your employees will, you know, write open letters about how much they love working there. But if you were to, for one moment, take any position, you know, that was right of center or right of far left, you know, then that company starts getting, you know, boycotted and starts, you know, getting all the things that we know about. So I think that because of the creation of an environment in the country where left is right and right is wrong, that filters down to an environment where advertisers can't participate in right-wing content or right-of-center content. And that filters down to a position where no mainstream media company can own right-of-center content. So of course, the big media companies know that the number one or two most profitable cable network in the country is a conservative network, right? Of course they know that. If you take out ESPN, Fox News channels, probably even with ESPN, the number one channel on cable, 24/7, but nobody can compete with it, because if Disney buys a right of center cable channel, people are going to take it out on Disney World. They're going to start boycotting Disney World or boycotting ESPN or boycotting any of the other holdings that Marvel movies, God forbid. Right. So the risk is too high, even though the reward is also high, for anyone to ever try it.
This is fascinating. All right. Two questions. First, has it gotten worse? You've been in the business for a while. You've been, involved with like Glenn when he was essentially in the CNN environment. I was just actually listening to Keith Olbermann's podcast, which I have to say, I highly recommend to anyone who enjoys watching just a psychopath have a podcast. He was talking about how Michael Savage was on MSNBC not that long ago. I mean, these networks were experimenting with things that were outside of what they would now be able to potentially have even on the air at this point. Tucker Carlson was obviously at MSNBC not that long ago, and in this grand scheme of things, 15 years ago. So do you think it's gotten worse in terms of what's untouchable and toxic? Let's start there.
I think yes. It's hard to have perspective, on it, because there's such a recency bias to anything that happens, in the media environment. And it always feels like the worst times ever, even though sometimes it's actually a good time. I do think that there even was a time where mainstream, not that long ago, where mainstream advertisers could, that Fox News was the exception, that Fox News was carved out because reaches such a massive audience that, Ford or GM or someone would say, okay, maybe I'm going to get a little bit of, flack for this, but, we need to reach these people, right? Yeah. It's the number one
benefit. Yeah.
Right. We'll do it. That time has passed. And I think it is because of, the level of sophistication of the political opponents, right, that have gotten better and better at, attacking, I hate to blame everything on social media or Twitter, but, the ability to mobilize a Twitter mob to put a run on Silicon Valley Bank is the same thing that you can do to mobilize a Twitter mob to put a run on, a GM commercial that ran on Fox News Channel. So, I think that reactionary component is that ganging up a Twitter mob, however you want to define it, is bad for the ability of really any media to get involved in anything that's outside of the current, popular narrative or groupthink.
Right. Yeah. Anything that's not even necessarily politically, it's just whatever's not, toxic enough. But my other question is, okay. So Twitter mobs and all that, like, do you think it's perception or reality in the sense of like, if ABC Disney buys some, not even conservative, like a right of center type network, causes the Twitter mob, the activists to galvanize with the reporters who, pretend they're doing reports but are actually, activist journalists. Does that then translate to the bottom line getting hurt? To real people that are not overly politically spun actually taking action in that sense? Or is it more perception?
I think they're the ability to withstand it does not exist any longer. So I think the hypothetical question is, if you could withstand it, if you could wait out the initial, people who are mad, and then they organize, and then the Twitter people come in after you for 48 hours, then the media writes about it for, a week, right? And then they're not getting results, so they go back to the Twitter people, and they find something. Then they're going to go, okay, well, this isn't working. Let's go after them for something else. Like, let's, you know, it's my belief that ultimately the media can destroy anyone or anything, you know, that there, that no, there's no perfect person and there's no perfect company. And if you look deep enough, hard enough, for long enough, ask enough people about someone or something, they're toast. So, you know, if they go, they're going to go all the way. And if that doesn't work, they're going to start finding other, you know, avenues. If you could make it past all that, maybe you've got a shot. But there is no, you know, the corporate executive that has the wherewithal, they're standing with their press and reporters and employees and investors and everybody to get through that. That is, you know, I can count them on one hand, right? It's yeah. A very, very small group of people who would have that level of capital.
Yeah. And I guess courage on some level also. All right, kind of leads me to another thing. So I started a publication back in 2015 on Medium called Autonomous. You wrote a column there, a guest column. It was the day the publication launched. And it was about why publishers should give in to Facebook for now. Facebook was kind of like the big hot topic at the time. You could probably insert in pretty much whatever else, you know, right now. But that, especially in the sense of like, and I would say media that is, you know, maybe not welcome in certain places, whether it's, let's just say, you know, the Apple Podcast Store or even, you know, some people on the right might say YouTube. You know, where do you fall on what you would advise brands, you know, publishers, outlets, when it comes to places that they may not be welcome, but like, you know, using the tools that are out there despite that versus, you know, going outside of that, like to a Rumble or those sorts of outlets?
Yeah. I mean, my view is that you want to be on every platform that you can be allowed to be on, right? That you want to be as big as you possibly can be, that you want to be as mainstream as you possibly can be. And one example of that is, you know, certainly YouTube, right? I'm not a believer in folding up shop on YouTube and going all in on Rumble. YouTube has, you know, 6 trillion daily active users, whatever the number is, right? Everybody on earth, and it's growing still. And so, you know, turning that audience off is, you know, mostly to your own detriment. There are obviously exceptions, right? Dan Bongino, he owns part of it. You know, he can make a big stink about going off YouTube and going onto Rumble. There may be strategic reasons to do that, but you know, for the most part, being everywhere is a big part of my model. The other thing is, the other place that I think is an example of that is publishing. I'm still a believer that Simon & Schuster and, you know, the other big publishers are the most successful when it comes to having your book get into Walmart or having your book get into, you know, bookstores in the airport and other places and using their co-op and their leverage and all the other things. So if you're a conservative and you can get a book deal with a major publisher versus, say, publishing it yourself on Amazon, you should, you know. Yeah. You know, that's, you know, another example I would say is we run a television network called The First TV, and we recently got added to DirecTV. You know, that's, some people would say DirecTV is hostile to conservative views, or DirecTV is, you know, it's a mainstream media company. Of course, it's a mainstream media company. And do I think for a minute that they're sitting there going, you know, we really want to have, you know, more conservative, you know, views. We got to get 100 conservative network. Of course not. But I think that for us, it's been great, you know, for us to be involved in, you know, in 13 million homes and for the shows to be exposed to a you know, a mass platform, you know, of course, that's better than, you know, just streaming on our website.
Coming up, the state of the podcast business and the traits that all top talent Chris has worked with, and there are many, share. That's next. But first, one of the most ethically compromised areas for the corporate media in the weeks, months, and years ahead will be the coverage of the social media platform TikTok. It's important for consumers of content to understand what's not being said and the barriers to clear-eyed reporting that's currently being navigated. On a big scale, there's the China connection, the CCP's direct involvement in the social platform. Many large media organizations have a China connection themselves, overtly or passively. Then there's the fact that TikTok is part of the marketing and social strategy at these large organizations. The Washington Post has several TikTok-only reporters. Plus, of course, there's the fact that many young reporters, like young people in general, enjoy using TikTok incessantly, like Taylor Lorenz, also at the Washington Post. Two recent articles shed big picture light on the other challenges. Politico pointed out how the campaign to save TikTok has been years in the making, as the company has been preparing for this coming battle with the government for years. TikTok is cozy with Anita Dunn and her PR firm, while Dunn is a part of the Biden administration. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal looked at how other top PR spinsters like Jim Messina and David Plouffe from the Hillary and Obama teams are part of the TikTok efforts as well. Of course, Dunn, Messina, and Plouffe are all cozy with the Acela Media in D.C. too. This whole exercise played out in public recently during the congressional hearings when the TikTok CEO was grilled by both sides of the aisle. Washington Post tech reporter Drew Harwell is consistently one of the most friendly reporters for the TikTok spin, and he displayed that even before he began live tweeting the hearings, noting his lunch with the CEO, who lamented the real shame it would be to lose U.S. voices on the platform. What followed was as instructive as it was embarrassing. His thread attacking Republicans, attacking Facebook, offering defense after defense of the freedom TikTok users have to post what they want. At one point, he tweeted about a congressman saying that the former NBA player Enes Kanter Freedom had been banned on TikTok. Drew's knee-jerk instinct was to go into defense mode once again. Not clear what he's talking about, he tweeted. He has 362,000 TikTok followers and posts videos there critical of the Chinese government all the time. A few days later, Harwell took a break from tweeting incessantly to write a story. The headline, TikTok admits it banned former NBA player critical of China. It's one of the great things about Twitter. Members of the press treat it like it's their diary, and yet it's public for all to see. Harwell defended his actions when I pressed him about it on Twitter. I contacted him and the company to understand what was happening. Then I wrote a news story about it, which is something we do called reporting, he said. Sure, he reported the story after the world could see his instinct was to run cover for the CCP-owned social platform he happens to do PR work for while moonlighting as an objective tech journalist. But this is the problem for journalists like Harwell and, more significantly, newsrooms like the Washington Post. I don't know if TikTok should be banned in the United States. I'm generally for more freedom, not less. But the China element here can't be ignored. And the conflicts of interests are so immense among the corporate press entities. They are severely compromised in ways everyone in the audience needs to understand while this story gets reported out. The Washington Post would be helped to find reporters who don't brag about their lunch with TikTok CEO, or at the very least, tweet a lot less while they do the actual work. More with Chris coming up, but I want to tell you that the full Fourth Watch podcast is available exclusively to paid subscribers on Substack. Yes, Fourth Watch has gone independent in 2023. Paid subscribers get a whole bunch of extra content, from original deep dive columns called Rabbit Hole to the full podcasts each episode. Check it out for just $5 a month or $50 for a year at fourthwatch.media. Now back to Chris Balfe.
Well, and also, I guess let's go to another platform, which is podcast. It's an area that, you know, you've been involved in for a very long time. And I have also, and it's one of the areas I would say that's, it's shockingly not as different as I maybe would have thought it would be, over the last 10 plus years. Like Spotify has gotten more involved on some capacity. They're, you know, buying up some, but for the most part, it doesn't feel like a lot has changed there. And I wonder, like, where you see, obviously the business has grown, you know, we see the numbers of revenue when it comes to podcasts. Certainly the number of podcasts has exploded, but the actual, like, the top tier podcasts, you know, the numbers are slowly growing, revenue slowly growing. I mean, are we, the boom maybe that was predicted is kind of slowed a little bit? Where do you think it stands right now, 2023?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great business. You know, I love the podcast business. I think it's opened up, you know, what we're calling podcasts are really shows. And, yeah. there's video components to many of them. You know, a lot of podcasts that we're working with are making as much money on YouTube and, you know, through video simulcasts and elsewhere as they are in audio. So, you know, podcasting has grown both in the, you know, quote unquote pivot to video, in the, you know, successful, you know, monetization through platforms that have been built out by companies like iHeart and Spotify. I think we're going to look back and say that this was a golden age to be able to launch something inexpensively and get a big audience. You know, I think if you look forward 10 years, I always feel like, YouTube is that way as well. Like, YouTube is so big and so successful. You know, I remember they did that campaign at one point where you drive around and see these billboards of like somebody you've never heard of has 40 million followers or something like that. It's its own planet. And I think that as hard as it is to, you know, launch a new show today and to, you know, get to a million, you know, subscribers on YouTube or, you know, half a million downloads of your podcast, as hard as that is today, in 5 or 10 years, it's going to be exponentially harder because those platforms are going to continue to grow and get more competitive. Big money is going to flow into them from major companies. So it's a great time to be in the podcasting business. It's a great time to launch a podcast or a show. It's a great time to try to promote it. Obviously harder than it was 3 years ago or 5 years ago to grow it, but it will be harder 5 years from now. You know, I think to your point about how it's been, how it hasn't changed, you know, ultimately the reason is because Apple deems it to be an irrelevant, you know, amount of money to them. You know, that the $2 billion industry, if they were able to capture a 100% market share of it, nobody would notice when they read the next earnings report for Apple, right? So it's just such a big company that plays an outsized role in a business that they clearly don't care about and is just, you know, irrelevant on its face, right? It doesn't take much to look at the numbers of the podcast industry and say, you know, they would rather figure out how to sell another 100,000 phones or whatever and make that money. So I think that's good. I'm happy that they've been, you know, laissez-faire about it, that they've allowed, you know, they've continued to develop. And it's, you know, the podcast app's better than it was, but it's not, they haven't tried to undo RSS or, you know, create their own formats or insert their own ads or anything like that. And I think that's allowed, you know, a more free and open environment. If they had taken a heavier hand the way Spotify has, maybe the industry would be $5 billion and not two. So I don't think it's necessarily clear that them being laissez-faire is always, you know, only good and not bad, but it's been certainly, it's been good for the independent spirit of it.
Yeah. That's interesting. So yeah, I mean, as you think more people, you know, every year start listening to podcasts, it actually, you know, we'll be getting progressively harder to grow a big audience if you're a fully independent creator in that way than it is right now.
Yeah. And even the network side, I think, you know, there's a big difference for how hard it is to launch a show for a big network today than it was 2 years ago. Yeah. Competition is intense. When you listen to podcasts, you hear so many promos for other podcasts. You know, you're like, if I just listened to every podcast that this podcast told me to listen to, I would, you know, I would list the podcast for the next 2 weeks. So, you know, I think that there's, it's going to be harder and harder to grow new shows. And so as hard as it is now, you know, now's the time.
Interesting. I want to ask you kind of about your career. You know, you started at a fascinating, you know, run, very rapid rise to success. But before we get to sort of the beginning, I want to just sort of look at, I always think about the people that I've worked with, like at the very, very, very top, kind of like, I describe them as like unicorns, like media unicorns, people that are singular, it's like an NBA term, you know, Giannis, Embiid, Luca, they're single people. And you've certainly had the opportunity to cross paths with a lot of those. And I wonder what you sort of lessons there might be or things that you've learned that say, you know, here are some things that maybe are through lines between the top talent, how people get to the very, very top of the game, totally unique, distinguished individuals, but traits that they may have that separate them from everyone else that make them so successful.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things that I think that everybody, you know, who's at that A plus list, you know, that I've worked with have. And they're not going to be things that are going to shock you. You're not going to be, oh my God, you know, he gave me this wisdom that no one's ever given me before. I think there are things that are, you know, they're just easier said than done things. One is originality, you know, uniqueness. The people who have reached that stratosphere, you know, Glenn Beck, there's no other Glenn Beck, right? There's nobody else. Everything he does, every, you know, time he wakes up in the morning, he has a thought that no one in the history has ever had, right? That's a skill or a trait or a talent that people really value is hearing from someone that has interesting, different, unique, original, creative thoughts in their head every morning. And it's obviously our mutual, person that we work with, Megan Kelly, superstar, is in that category, right? Every morning she wakes up and she has a take on something that's like, wow. So I would point to, really all of the people that I work with now, that have that, another one is Jesse Kelly, who if you read his Twitter feed, you might be terrified by it, but you might also realize that he has something really interesting, really different, really unique to say. He's not just reacting to whatever happened in the news today. He is creating the news, which is another thing that Glenn was incredible at and that Megan is incredible at. And Tucker is another one I would say right now is at the top of the game of people who are able to, create the news. The second thing, even more obnoxious observation, is that they all work really, really, really hard. That these are people who, Nancy Grace is a great example of one of our clients who, I mean, she works so hard, nothing's given to her. She doesn't just, sit around and wait for the phone to ring. She's saying to her team every day, let's book this person. Let's talk about this case. She researches these cases like crazy so that whatever a person asks her about it, she knows that she has a view on it. And of course she's original and goes back to my point one, she's original, she's creative, she's all those things. But, Glenn works himself, half to death when we were working together. All of these people have an incredible work ethic, and that's what it takes to get to the top. Incredible work ethic plus an originality, a uniqueness that is singular.
Yeah, it is funny. Like I feel like in other industries, maybe like business or entertainment, how do you become like the biggest movie star? Originality probably still crosses over, but not necessarily that work ethic in the way that it does in the media. Like the people that are at the very top of the game, like they can relax a little bit but like, it's not that way. There's something innate in the people that are these huge media stars that's like, they just want to then work even more and harder and you better be along for that ride. It is interesting.
Yeah. And it's something about our business too, right? All these people have to do 5 days a week, but really you're talking about in some cases, take Jesse Kelly. Jesse Kelly's doing 3-hour national radio show on 200 radio stations. That's almost impossible to do that well. Then he's doing a custom hour every day for WR in New York City, just about New York stuff. Then he's doing an hour on the First TV every day. So he's doing 5 hours a day of television of
content. Yeah.
Crazy. Then he's writing for Twitter. He's writing a book. He's, doing videos for all these other platforms. It's like, and people go, oh my gosh, he's had this stratospheric, rise. And he has, come from nowhere to be, insanely successful in the last 2 years, but it's because he's working his ass off,
Right.
The content demands are such of this business that you can't, I'm not implying that actors don't work hard. I don't know if they do or don't, because I don't know them well enough, but you certainly could go film a movie, work really hard for 26 weeks, and then go take a few, take a few months off. None of our folks can, take 2 months off.
No, they can't take the foot off the gas, and they don't want to.
They wouldn't take some month off. That's pretty, That's right.
It's a good mental health break. All right. Let me ask you before we get to kind of the end here, your own start and how you got it. Because I know you told me the story way back, I think when we first met, but I think it's really an interesting one for people to understand. Talk about working hard and having a vision and making it happen for yourself. But if you don't mind, kind of tracing the roots of how you got involved in this business.
Yeah. So, going all the way back, I was a fan of Glenn Beck's radio program when he was doing a morning zoo style show in New Haven, Connecticut on KC101. And I was 16, and he was, I was also was and am a technology geek, and I love technology, and I'm super into it. And I was building websites when I was 16. So I don't know. 1995 or something like that. So I was a fan of Glenn. So I think I was sort of a ruse to figure out how to meet him and, get a chance to meet somebody who I admired. I took a drive to a coffee shop in Hamden, Connecticut called the Daily Grind, where he was doing a remote. I showed up right at 10 o'clock because I knew that if he pulled, you know, if I showed up at 9:50, he would pull me on the air for the last break and make fun of the geeky kid who showed up and offered to build him a website. And I did. I offered to build him a website, and he took a, you know, on a coffee napkin, a Sharpie, and he wrote his home phone number on it, handed it to me, and he said, you know, give me a call. So, you know, I started doing stuff for him on the website. We did like really crazy. Like I held the webcam and we streamed a live radio show of his in like 1996, you know, like
wow.
Doing this on a website. And then, you know, I went to, UConn briefly. I dropped out of UConn. I worked for Accenture, in the Boston office, and so they were creating something called .com launch centers in the early days of startup mania, where everybody .com bubble won. Everybody was trying to figure out how to start new companies in the internet space. And I had even though I dropped out of college, I had a lot of internet experience. So worked on some clients there. And then I got a call from Glenn in 2001. And he was down in Florida and I was up in Boston. And he said, you know, I've been given this opportunity to go, you know, nationwide and do talk radio from 9 a.m. to noon Eastern time. And, you know, I want to talk about it. I went down to Tampa and met him, and, you know, he laid out a vision. He said, I want to, you know, people told me that I could be the next, Rush Limbaugh, but I don't want to be the next Rush Limbaugh. I want to be the next Oprah. I want to have stage shows, and I want to have an internet business. And I want to have, you know, books and a magazine, all these other things. And so, you know, fresh out of my, Accenture management training, I went to the whiteboard and I said, you know, here's how you do it. Do this first and do this first, you know, like what I knew, and I was 21, how to do this. Right. And he was like, oh, well, why don't you come and, you know, work for me? And I was like, well, you know, first of all, I've got a job at, you know, Accenture as a college dropout. So that's a job paying well. And, you know, probably not going to get it if I leave. And secondly, you know, he was an unproven, you know, he was a very successful afternoon, you know, radio host in Tampa, but it wasn't clear that and obvious that this was going to work, that he was going to be as, you know, as big as he ultimately became. So, but I did, I dropped out of, you know, I moved from Boston to Philly and left Accenture. And as I always say, I called my mom and told her that her college dropout son was leaving a major consulting company and going to work for a radio DJ that she had never heard of. And she cried. You know, it was an incredible decision. You know, I don't know, but that's the best decision of my life, but probably right up there, because it put me in this business, put me in the career, put me around Glenn for, you know, 2001 to 2014. So 13 or 14 years that we were able to work together and, you know, build that business up. So it was awesome.
Yeah. It's incredible. Cause I mean, really, like when you say build that business up, I mean, start from people that think about starting from scratch, you know, it's just the Barstool story has been out there a lot, as you know, Dave cashed in his chips 20 years, you know, from handing out the newspapers, that, you know, the rise of what you and Glenn built together there from 2001 to, really, I mean, I would say 2011, let's just, you know, 2011, 2012, going off and launching the Blaze and GBTV was incredible. So amazing story.
Yeah, it was a crazy time. I think, you know, I don't ever appreciate it while you're going through it necessarily, but I think, you know, what's cool now is, you know, getting to work with talent and, you know, using the experience that we've had both with Glenn and since to, you know, to bring, to deliver, you know, results for them. But I think there's also something, and that's so fun, but doing something the first time, which was what we were doing every single day or every week or every month with Glenn and the Blaze, there's something really unique about that. It's like, we're going to go and do a deal with CNN. You know, what's that? Like, what's that contract look like? What are the parameters of that negotiation? How are we going to, you know, sit in a room as a, you know, I don't know, you punk kid, whatever age, and negotiate with, you know, the president of CNN or whatever. So now I'm older and wiser and can use those experiences to benefit, you know, other talent. And that's also fun. You know, I love working with Jesse and, you know, again, doing these things that, you know, I think that we have unique insights into and how to do them and do them well. But, you know, the other thing is also like, it starts with incredible talent. Like,
yeah.
one, runs a singular talent. Jesse, I think, is too, and Megan, and you know, lots of the folks that we work with. So, you know, none of it. I can work really hard, but if I'm, you know, don't have somebody that's at that level, there's always going to be a cap.
More with Chris, including the Fourth Watch Lightning Round on his time working with and at Fox News, available for paid subscribers of Fourth Watch on Substack. Go to fourthwatch.media to try it. Thanks so much to Chris Balfe. Find out more about him and his organization at redseatventures.com. Remember, Fourth Watch is not just a podcast, it's also a newsletter. Subscribe for free now at fourthwatch.media. Join me, let's build a better media together. If you like the music in the show as I do, check out the artist who created it, Super Duper. That's Super Duper Music on Instagram. Got some new songs over there that are great. This song is Far From Falling. Download it wherever you get your music. You can download, follow, like, rate, review to this podcast, the Fourth Watch Podcast, at Apple, Spotify, Substack, wherever you get your podcasts. Back soon. Stay safe. Talk to you then.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.